Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdert Kennedy. Chapter 46. Joseph Pulitzer. Concord, New Hampshire. Mr. Joseph Pulitzer, Bar Harbor, Maine. My dear Mr. Pulitzer, you are a comparatively old man, and your years, your character, and your accomplishments entitle you to the respect and kindly regard of your fellows. That which is due you, and which you have a right to expect at the hands of men, is due from you and yours to others under like or similar conditions. Few, if any, women living have done so much to pass their names to posterity as has Reverend Mary Baker G. Eddy of this city and state. And we of Concord, regardless of religious beliefs, have great respect for this woman. And we resent any indignity aimed at her or passed upon her, and every decent man and woman in Concord experiences a sense of disappointment and shame on realizing that a great newspaper, like the World, through the overzeal of its representatives, would annoy her or cause her discomfort by appealing to low natures or those given to gossip or envy, to secure guesses or opinions about her, unworthy of the World, unworthy of Mrs. Eddy, and unworthy of the intelligence, integrity, and manhood and womanhood of New Hampshire's capital city. My dear Mr. Pulitzer, I have met and talked with you once. I have met and talked with Mrs. Eddy more than once. I know her. She knows me. I have been in her home, in her study, with her within a few months, and discussed with her many things. I have bowed to her in her carriage within 48 hours, and my salutation has been returned by her. If the intent of the World's representatives to Concord be carried out in its columns, the World will say, in substance, that Mrs. Eddy is dead, and that a mummy or substitute, and not she, is in the carriage each day when it passes through the main streets of our city, and its occupant is greeted by our people. Or it will say, Mrs. Eddy is enfeebled and decrepit, and that those brilliant faculties which in the past made her wonderful accomplishment possible have departed. To every statement, or even insinuation of this kind, I, as one who knows, say it is not true, in whole or in part, but on the contrary is unqualifiedly false. This letter to you is not occasioned by any special zeal on my part in the cause of Christian Science, nor is it occasioned by any blind adherence to or worship of persons or advocacies, but solely in a spirit of justice, truth, square dealing, a becoming regard for brains and respectability, as well as reverence for age and motherhood. I am very truly yours, signed Michael Meehan, October 26, 1906. So did Michael Meehan, editor of Concord's daily paper, The Patriot, seek at the 11th hour to stave off the blow. As a newspaper man, he, in common with many others in Concord, knew what was coming. About the middle of September, two reporters from the New York World had made their appearance in Concord, evidently with instructions to allow nothing to stand in the way of a ruthless investigation of Mrs. Eddy and all that concerned her, such as none knew better than Pulitzer how to set in motion. They came armed with all manner of evidence. A few months previously, Georgine Milmine had undertaken to write a life of Mrs. Eddy for McClure's magazine. She set about the task with a will, and after interviewing Frederick Peabody, who had acted as attorney for Mrs. Woodbury in her abortive suit against Mrs. Eddy some years previously, returned to New York with such amazing revelations that McClure's felt sure they had the story of the century, and at once detailed other members of the staff, namely Will Irwin, Burton Hendrick, and Willa Cather, to collaborate with Miss Milmine in its production. As rumors of the coming story spread throughout the journalistic world of New York, they lost nothing in the telling, and it was not long before the world, at Pulitzer's insistent demand, was hard at work seeking to anticipate the McClure revelations and render them even more sensational. Two reporters were sent to Concord to commence the work there. They delved into Mrs. Eddy's past with earnest enthusiasm. They traced carefully her every transaction in real estate, away back to her first purchase of the little house on Broad Street in Lynn. They investigated her copyrights, and in both connections viewed with rising suspicion Mrs. Eddy's practice, specially noticeable in her later years, of apparently turning over her equities to others. Thus, in 1899, they found that she had transferred the copyrights of her books to Edward Kemble, and that he, for no good reason that they could see, had in 1906 turned them over to Calvin Fry. Surely this was just what the chief had insisted, that Mrs. Eddy, mentally incapacitated, was in the hands of designing persons who were taking it turn about to share her substance between them. So sure, indeed, were the world men that they had discovered something momentous, such as could not be gainsaid, that they determined to confront some well-known Concord businessmen with the facts they had unearthed, and secure the support of their admissions as to their correctness. The two chosen were Frederick N. Ladd, Mrs. Eddy's cousin, who was secretary of the Loan and Trust Savings Bank in Concord, and J. Wesley Plummer, treasurer of the Concord Church. Both men seem to have received the suggestion of the reporters that Mrs. Eddy was mentally incompetent, with a quite disconcerting amusement, were entirely unimpressed by the evidence they had accumulated, and possibly advised them to go to Pleasant View and find out for themselves whether Mrs. Eddy was mentally competent or not. Anyway, within a few days, the two men did actually present themselves at Pleasant View and demanded to see Mrs. Eddy. No previous announcement had been made of their intentions, and at first, Calvin Fry and other members of the household were quite at a loss to know what to do. They had heard of the rumors that were going around, and it seemed a simple matter to settle the question of Mrs. Eddy's existence and mental capacity once and for all by acquiescing in the demand in spite of the evident truculence with which it was made. But Mrs. Eddy was in her 86th year. Save in her daily drives, she had little contact with the world, and what little she had never exposed her to anything but gentleness and consideration. These two New York newspaper men had evidently little of either quality about them. They did not ask to see Mrs. Eddy. They demanded the right to see her, and virtually made it clear that they did not propose to leave the house till they had seen her. Fry finally compromised the situation by asking them to come back at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, when he would see what could be done. Mrs. Eddy would be back from her drive by that time, and it might be possible for them to see her. As far as Calvin Fry and Laura Sargent and the other members of the household were concerned, this action represented no more than an effort to gain time. They shrank from the prospect of exposing Mrs. Eddy to such a contact. But there seemed no other way out of it. And at last, reluctantly, they took their problem, as they always did in the end, to Mrs. Eddy herself. And Mrs. Eddy solved it promptly by saying that she would see the two men. When 3 o'clock came round and the reporters returned, they were shown into her study. As they stood in the doorway, Mrs. Eddy rose from her desk to greet them. Next moment, the two men were overwhelming her with questions. They had done what no other reporters had done, and they were determined to make the most of it. Mrs. Eddy answered calmly at first, but it was not long before Fry and Lewis Strang, another member of her household, intervened, and the interview was brought to a close. The two reporters, realizing, no doubt, that interpreted as they intended to interpret it, they already had more than enough material to make the story Pulitzer wanted, left the house without further protest. One thing, however, remained to be done. Pulitzer was insistent that Mrs. Eddy, if not actually dead, was at any rate so incapacitated that she could not leave the house, and that the woman who took a daily drive in her carriage through Concord was not Mrs. Eddy, but some other woman made up to impersonate her. If they could establish this as a fact, their work would be complete and their commendation sure. They laid their plans carefully. Every day, punctually, at 2 o'clock, Mrs. Eddy's carriage swung through the gates of Pleasant View on its way to Concord. The carriage, however, was a closed one, and in the bright afternoon sunlight, its interior was very much in shadow. And so, after haunting the entrance to the drive for several days, without being able to make quite sure, they determined to make their evidence such as could not be controverted. A day or two later, as the carriage slowed down near the entrance, they jumped on the running board, one on each side, calculating that if Mrs. Eddy turned her head away from one, the other would only get a better view. It all happened in a moment, and was all over before Mrs. Eddy had recovered from her surprise, or Calvin Fry, who was on the box as usual, from his indignation. But the two world men had got what they wanted. As was subsequently shown beyond doubt, the occupant of the carriage was Mrs. Eddy, as it always was. But in the account of the matter these men were writing for the world, Mrs. Eddy had already been portrayed as in the last stages of senile decay. It would, therefore, be a simple matter for them to find that the chief was right and that the occupant of the carriage was not Mrs. Eddy. It was a lurid story, and Michael Meehan, with the sixth sense of a good journalist, knowing what was contemplated, had determined to make an 11th-hour attempt to prevent the appearance of anything so scandalous. Hence his letter to Pulitzer. The hope was a forlorn one, and he must have known it. Joseph Pulitzer did not even answer Meehan's letter. And in the columns of the World on the following Sunday morning, October 28th, appeared an article on Mrs. Eddy and her household at Pleasant View, which, by reason of its quite shameless malice and misstatement, was, within a few days, to arouse a large section of the American press to vigorous protest. In a series of scare headlines, which spread themselves over the front page of one of the world's many sections, it was announced that Mrs. Eddy was dying, that she was controlled by a footman and impersonated by a dummy, that she was hopelessly affected with cancer and immured at Pleasant View, while another woman impersonates her on the streets of Concord. Calvin Fry, Secretary Footman, Supreme Power at the Eddy Home. The headlines went on. Mrs. Eddy's fortune estimated at $15 million. Her income at $1 million a year. Members of her coterie say she spent it all in charity, though no records of large gifts can be found. And then came the story of the interview. Surely, in the light of what subsequently transpired, one of the most amazing travesties that ever was published. Distasteful as is the task, the historian is compelled to quote, at least in part, the world's article. For in no other way could the incredible malignancy of the attack be shown, and the forces behind a vastly more ambitious attack to follow understood. Here are typical passages. Mrs. Eddy looked more dead than alive. She was a skeleton, her hollow cheeks thick with red paint, and the fleshless, hairless bone above the sunken eyes penciled a jet black. The features were thick with powder. Above them was a big white wig. Her body was pitifully emaciated, and her throat, on which sparkled a horseshoe of brilliance, was shriveled. Her weakness was pathetic. She reeled as she stood, clinging to the table. Her sunken, faded eyes glazed helplessly, almost pleadingly, at her visitors. The air of the room reeked with the odors of powerful stimulants. In a corner, as though hastily pushed aside, stood a galvanic battery with its surgical basin half full of water and a sponge wet from use. To every eye, it was clear that the unfortunate old woman had been doped and galvanized for the ordeal of identification. But it was equally clear that the utmost stimulation could not keep the tortured woman upon her feet much longer. Strang glided to her side and held an outstretched arm behind her in readiness for the threatened collapse. But old Mrs. Eddy was nerved to supreme effort. Her listless eyes were fastened upon Professor Kent as he stepped towards her. As he bowed formally, she released her hold upon the table, swayed toward him, clutched him with her shriveled fingers, and held on with desperate strength. Had Professor Kent withdrawn his support, she must have fallen. "My dear, dear Professor," she cried in the high, cackling voice of extreme age, "how glad I am to see you. Let me congratulate you on getting back your position. I am so glad that you are at the head of your school again." It was the senseless chatter of senility. Professor Kent, years ago, severed all connections with the Concord School. As he stammered out a reply and gently freed himself from the quivering fingers, Mrs. Eddy turned reeling again to the table and clung to it for support. Her fictitious strength was almost gone. She had just strength enough left to extend a palsied hand to each visitor and motion appealingly to Strang. The interview was at an end. It had lasted only 3 minutes. No so-called scoop in the history of modern journalism has received more emphatic or more general condemnation than did this tour de force of the New York World. Concord, on that Sunday morning, was literally out in the streets about it before the sun was well up. As soon as possible, the mayor, the Honorable Charles R. Corning, accompanied by General Streeter, a member of the National Republican Committee and one of the foremost lawyers in New England, drove out to Pleasant View to place their services at Mrs. Eddy's disposal. And on their return to Concord, gave to a representative of the Associated Press, who had come hot afoot to Concord, statements combating in detail the absurdities and misstatements of the World's article. Mayor Corning declared indignantly that he had known Mrs. Eddy for years, that he saw her driving past his office almost every day, that he had just seen her, talked with her for half an hour, that he had found her, as usual, keen of intellect and strong in memory. A surprising illustration of longevity, with bright eyes, emphatic expression, and alertness rarely encountered in a person so venerable. General Streeter testified to much the same purpose. Mrs. Frank Leonard from New York, who had been accused by The World of impersonating Mrs. Eddy, wired that she had never in her life stepped inside Mrs. Eddy's carriage. Michael Meehan, editor of The Patriot, Josiah E. Fernald, president of the National State Capital Bank, J. Wesley Plummer, deputy state treasurer, and George H. Moses, then editor of the Concord Evening Monitor and later United States Senator from New Hampshire, all denied emphatically that there was a word of truth in The World's story. Next day, the press of the country left no doubt as to its reaction. Led by the New York Journal, The World's great rival, condemnation of the most emphatic kind was almost universal. The New York World said the Journal continues its personal and vicious hounding of Mrs. Eddy, leader of the Christian Science religion. The account which it publishes of recent events in Mrs. Eddy's home could reflect credit upon no newspaper and upon no man. The effect of it all upon Joseph Pulitzer can only be surmised. He was used to storms and had weathered many. But in each and all of them, he had always managed to preserve some claim to be heard, justification for his action, which enabled him to outride even the most violent storms of protest. But here the World stood before the country, not only as the perpetrator of a deliberate slander, but as doing it with a naivete and clumsiness past belief. Pulitzer said nothing at the time. He made no attempt to justify his action, but during the next few weeks, in the cabin of his yacht at Bar Harbor, he laid plans for a revenge which must rank as one of the most remarkable in the history of American courts.